The world is supported by Wise, the smart new way to move money internationally. Imagine a world where you could speak any language, travel to any place, and spend in any currency with ease. At Wise, they're building the money part. Wise is the world's most international account. It lets you hold and convert dozens of currencies all in one place. And you always get the real exchange rate with no markups like the banks sometimes give you. So whether you're sending money to Australia, hopping on a plane to Poland, or getting paid from France, Wise is all you need. Designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
As the Taliban takes over parts of Afghanistan with alarming speed, Afghans living abroad are desperate to get their families out and to safety.
I may be a little bit naive in being optimistic, but I have to do everything I can for my family to give them a chance to live.
Also today, to get into parts of Europe, you may soon need to be vaccinated against COVID, and it matters which vaccine you've got to get your ticket punched.
It's ridiculous, because the message is, whichever vaccine you get, take it. Now people have to make choices.
And gas prices are steadily creeping higher. President Biden wants OPEC nations to pump out more oil. Their response? There is plenty already.
Which is basically a way of saying, no, we're not going to pump more, and you don't know what you're talking about.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. For millions of people in Afghanistan right now, the mood comes down to one word, fear. The Taliban has advanced across the country so widely and rapidly that many people are scrambling to find a way out of their country. We start today with what that looks like for one family. Lena Torrey-John is a student at Oxford University in the UK. Her family is back in Kabul, mom, siblings, nieces and nephews. In Oxford, Lena has been doing everything she can to find a way to help them get out, even crowdsourcing funds to pay for plane tickets. As the Taliban continues to advance toward Afghanistan's capital city, I asked Lena what the last few days have been like.
Incredibly stressful, to say the least. I look at my phone and every time a call comes, I think that this may be the call that says that my family is not alive anymore. I have been on the phone with my nieces and nephews daily. I ask them how they're feeling, what they're fearing, and also recording my communication with them in case this is the last time I talk with them. Unfortunately, it's been bringing back a lot of horrific memories from my childhood, such as when my school was attacked by the Taliban and when they killed my teachers and when the Taliban men would chase women and children on the streets with whips. So extremely distressing and heartbreaking.
And you're recording those conversations. You sound really worried.
I definitely am worried. So currently the family is coping by focusing on doing whatever we can to assist my mother, sister, and their family to get out before it's too late. One of my nieces, who is 11 years old, a smart, intelligent girl who has hopes of going to university, getting a diploma, she's been incredibly sad and she cries. But she said when she cries in her heart because she does not want to discourage her mother. And one of my nephews, who is 9 years old, he told me he's preparing to leave and has gathered all his textbooks and says, I'll see you soon. So,
I mean, the options for people who want to leave Afghanistan seem really few. What options are there, actually?
I think right now, well, a lot of embassies have closed as well. So people could have possibly gone to Iran or Pakistan, but those land borders seem closed, and they could possibly get visas to go to these other countries, neighboring countries. But again, with the embassies closed, I think the options are very limited. I think there's this window that maybe within the next week or the next few days, with troops, U.S. troops and other troops going to help their diplomats and officials come out, I think there's that window of possibly getting on any flight that you can get to get out. But again, most Afghans don't have passports. They don't have the money. They don't know how to go through the system of getting a visa. They don't speak the language of the country. So people are just trapped.
There are private agencies that charge fees to make exit arrangements for people. What services do they offer and how much do those cost?
Oh, the private agencies, unfortunately, during a time like this, they have seen as an opportunity to make money. So for a visa for a country that was probably $50 before, now it's up to $750. And because people want to get out, now if you want to have any chance of living, people are getting together to put that money together to get out. But a lot of people are not going to be able to do that.
You set up a GoFundMe page to assist your family in getting out of Afghanistan. You're looking at seven people, your mother, sister, brother-in-law, and their four children. Is reaching out to the public this way for help really the best chance for people like your family to leave?
It was really hard for me to even put this fundraising together. But again, I'm very privileged to have people who have stepped in to help us. And I think this may be an option for some of us because others in Afghanistan may not even have bank accounts. Right now it's seven members of my family, but we've just got news that my relatives from Mazar are leaving. Some of them have gotten flyers with information that they need to marry their daughters to one of the Taliban. So they're just sending them to Kabul. So I've planned for seven people, but I think it's going to increase to 9 or 10, possibly.
Your family is Hazara, and because of their ethnicity, that puts them in even greater danger. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, Hazaras are an ethnic minority and marginalized group in Afghanistan who have been the target of systematic violence from the Taliban, but also from government and different ethnic groups. Our noticeable Asiatic appearance and our culture and linguistic difference make us an easy target for terrorist organizations and the dominant ethnic groups, and of course the Taliban. Hazaras have been carrying marks of ethnic cleansing, genocide, slavery, land confiscation. Almost all the attacks that has been planned, such as beheading, kidnapping, has been done by the Taliban and ISIS. And recently, you may have seen on the news that in Malistan, the Taliban killed over 49 Hazaras, and their only crime because they're Hazaras.
How are you thinking about the future of Afghanistan right now?
To be honest, at this point, the future is bleak. It's stunning how quickly two decades of progress for women, for education, for ethnic minorities can be erased within days. With the rise of Taliban regime, which currently appears practically inevitable, I shudder to think of the rampant human rights violations and the veil of oppression that will befall the nation for the foreseeable future. And I really request the international community to really think about their decision-making, their policy-making, and really humanize the people of Afghanistan and do their part in it.
Lena, if your family is able to resettle in a new place, would that be a temporary relocation with hopes eventually to return to Afghanistan?
For right now, it will be temporary with the hopes of relocating them to North America. So my brother-in-law served over 8, possibly in 10 years with the U.S. government, and his paperwork has been extremely slow. And if he doesn't get out, who he's spending in hiding right now, this could be it for him and for the rest of the family. So for somebody like him and for somebody like my family that belongs to an ethnic minority that's been target of the killing of the Taliban, there is really no glimpse of hope to go back anytime until the Taliban is completely removed from power.
Is it actually possible to leave Afghanistan then if you do have the money?
I hope so. I think I may be a little bit naive in being optimistic, but I personally feel like I have to do everything I can for my family to give them a chance to live. But honestly, deep in my heart, I feel like they may not be able to make it.
Lena Torrejon is a student at Oxford University. She's trying to get her family out of Afghanistan. Lena, our thoughts are with you. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.
As many Afghans struggle to find a way to leave, the U.S. is also reducing its staff at its embassy in Kabul. Yesterday, the Biden administration said it's sending 3,000 troops to Afghanistan to help evacuate embassy employees. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges is with us to discuss this. He's the former commanding general of the U.S. Army in Europe. He was also the director of operations, Regional Command South in Kandahar, Afghanistan. He joins us from South Carolina. General Hodges, are you surprised by how quickly events have unfolded in the last few days in Afghanistan?
Marco, I am surprised. I think surprised that how quickly Afghan security forces have collapsed in so many places. Obviously, this is worrying, but it's also disheartening because I've met so many quality Afghan soldiers that you would expect better.
What do you think about the decision to send back 3,000 U.S. troops?
Well, of course, the administration and the Department of Defense have to do this. They practice what we call NEO, non-combatant evacuation operations, a lot to evacuate embassies or other places around the world in when there's a crisis. So the administration, I think this is the obvious necessary step to ensure a safe evacuation of our diplomats and other Americans there.
So most recently, the U.S. had 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. Now another 3,000 are going, in addition to those who are still in country, to help out embassy staff with relocation. It's also deploying 4,000 troops to the region. How do you see these numbers? Help us understand them.
Well, what we're probably talking about is a Marine Expeditionary Unit or an organization that would have combined arms, infantry, medical, signal, perhaps even engineers, all the things necessary to carry out this kind of mission. What's probably hard, because I've been questioned on this a couple of times by family members, like, wait a minute, we had 2,500, we're pulling them out, and now we're sending 3,000 back in and 4,000 to other places. That,
right.
You know, the math seems strange, but of course, these are not one for one. These are completely different types of capabilities that are going in and out.
Could these troops end up fighting the Taliban?
I suspect that's a possibility. Of course, when a non-combatant evacuation operation is underway, they go in with lots of serious capability to deter anybody from trying to swarm, for example, or to cause problems during the departure.
So Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said yesterday the embassy in Kabul will continue to operate and that this is not an evacuation. Deploying 3,000 troops, though, and getting personnel on a military flight out, that does sound like an evacuation. What's your assessment?
Of course, John Kirby is exceptional. Not only was he a great Navy officer, he's an exceptional spokesman right now. And of course, our embassy will continue to operate. What we don't know is at what levels, you know, what services and capabilities will remain in place. And this is the kind of prudence that I think everybody would expect the Department of Defense and the Department of State to exercise.
U.S. strategists knew that what we're seeing was a possible outcome, that the U.S. would leave and the Taliban would gain in strength. Is what we're seeing now just the cold reality of U.S. policy?
Well, that's a fair question. When I think of how much time and energy so many Americans and Brits and Canadians and Germans and other allies put into helping to develop the Afghan National Security Forces, whether it's Army or Police or Air Force, of course, this is incredibly discouraging to see it collapse so fast. At the end of the day, the Afghans have got to decide that they're going to fight for their own country. We've invested a lot of time, money, blood. Afghan soldiers have died by the thousands over the last 20 years. I've met quality Afghan officers and soldiers, but at some point, their leadership has got to give them a reason to continue fighting. We know from history that the moral aspect of combat is more significant than the physical. And the Afghans have got to summon their moral courage as well, with or without American support.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges was the Director of Operations, Regional Command South in Kandahar, Afghanistan, from 2009 to 2010. General, thank you very much.
Thank you for what you guys are doing.
Coming up, President Biden wants OPEC to pump more oil. He also wants to lower greenhouse gases. Can he have it both ways? And travel to Europe, it doesn't just require a vaccine. It requires the right kind of vaccine. Stay with us. It's The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Many governments across the globe are fighting insurgencies right now. In Mozambique and southern Africa, they've been struggling to contain a rebellion for 4 long years. Thousands have died. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced in northern Mozambique in the province of Cabo Delgado. But there is hope that the tide may be turning. Here's The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi.
Earlier this week, the anthem of Mozambique played on a windy afternoon in Pemba, the capital of the Cabo Delgado province. It marked the launch of a new peacekeeping mission by the Southern African Development Community. SADC, as it's known, is an organization of 16 African nations. It's sending about 1,500 soldiers to help Mozambique fight a years-long insurgency. Major General Kalani Mankai from South Africa described the mission this way.
To support the Republic of Mozambique to combat acts of terrorism and violent extremism by neutralizing threats and restoring security in order to create a secure environment.
This is a turning point for Mozambique. The country has been reluctant to accept help and has denied the scope of the problem. Robert Bessling is the CEO of Pangea Risk, an intelligence company. He is based in South Africa.
They have been reluctant to do so. One, because a homegrown insurgency in the ruling parties, a home province, is deeply embarrassing and has huge political and symbolic reputational damage to it.
But that's changing as attacks in the region have continued. Last month, 1,000 troops from Rwanda arrived in Cabo Delgado. This week, the U.S. announced it would train 100 Mozambican commandos and rangers. The extra support appears to be making a difference already. This week, Mozambican and Rwandan forces freed the town of Mojimboa de Praia from insurgents. It was attacked last year. Mozambican General Cristorau Arthur Chume spoke with reporters about who these insurgents are.
There is some Mozambicans, Tanzanians, Somalians, DRC and other countries who lead this group. But how they act as a terrorist.
Still, there are a lot of unknowns about the insurgency in northern Mozambique. The region is predominantly Muslim. And earlier this year, the U.S. government said the militants are tied to ISIS. But many experts still are not so sure. Here's Besling, the analyst.
I very much doubt, and this is also backed up by very little evidence at the moment, that there are strong ties in terms of ideology, leadership, recruitment, funding, supply between the disparate insurgency in northern Mozambique and the different parts of Islamic State in Africa or beyond.
But one thing is clear about this insurgency. It's been deadly and destructive. Here's Mozambican General Cristorau Arthur Chume again.
They kill people, destroy infrastructure. If you go around, you will see how they act, what they want. They don't want people living in peace.
Many people in Cabo Delgado are happy to see the arrival of international troops. Here's one man speaking to Rwandan state media from Palma, a town that was decimated in a deadly attack back in March. Rwandan troops, he said, are bringing peace. Now he wants to bring his family home. But Zenaida Machado, a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch, advises caution.
What we would want the army to do at this stage is to make sure that the area is completely safe before they allow or encourage anyone to return home.
Machado says that the government needs to investigate alleged human rights abuses committed by the Mozambican security forces against civilians.
They had relatives that were enforced, disappeared, arbitrarily arrested, or ill-treated or beaten by security forces, or summarily executed.
As more troops arrive in Mozambique to fight the insurgents, Machado says human rights needs to be a top priority. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
This week, the Biden administration turned its sights on a favorite target for American presidents, OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries. OPEC controls more than 80% of the oil reserves on the planet. President Biden wants the 13 OPEC nations to pump out more oil. Biden is making the plea at the same time that Americans are dealing with high prices at the pump and as the U.S. is resistant to tap into its reserves. To unpack the global oil game, we're joined by Ellen Wald with the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center. She joins us from Jacksonville, Florida. How is OPEC responding to the Biden administration's criticisms and demands to increase output, Ellen?
OPEC hasn't issued a formal response, but there were some comments from OPEC delegates. And they basically amounted to, in our market analyses, we don't really see a need for more oil right now. So, which is basically a way of saying, no, we're not going to pump more. We already have plans to pump more oil. In fact, we're not going to pump more than we've planned and don't know what you're talking about.
And how does the White House see it? Does it see that that increased output is satisfactory?
Well, it seems like they don't think that this increased output is satisfactory. But in effect, OPEC is going to be increasing its production by 400,000 barrels a day each month from now through December and probably farther into 2022. So it's really kind of confusing as to why the Biden administration is pressing OPEC for even more oil now when they already have plans to increase it.
Right. So OPEC does get a lot of criticism from the White House when gas prices are high here. Is this criticism of OPEC fair?
It's not all OPEC's fault in this case. And gasoline prices in the United States aren't just a factor of OPEC. They are mostly a factor of oil prices, but there is more that goes into it. So, for example, last year or in, say, February of 2020, the U.S. was pumping 13 million barrels a day of oil. Now we're pumping much closer to 11. And that extra 2 million barrels a day doesn't seem like it's coming back. And a lot of that is due to policies that the Biden administration has put in place that discourage producers from expanding production domestically.
So why in this case do you think the U.S. president is saying OPEC needs to help? What's the rhetoric about?
Everyone's favorite villain is OPEC, essentially. And there's always a way to want to blame, say, Saudi Arabia or Russia for what's going on with gasoline prices, when in fact, some of the issue with gasoline prices is in fact inflation that is the fault of some of the policies that are going on right now. But it was a very convenient way to kind of deflect some of the attention that that inflation is getting and try to maybe shift the blame to OPEC.
The Biden administration's demanding OPEC increase oil production at the same time as increased rhetoric and action on combating climate change. Can the White House have it both ways here?
I don't think the White House can have it both ways. You know, if the Biden administration is really concerned that gasoline prices are going to hamper the economic recovery, then there are other steps that they can take other than asking for more oil to try to alleviate this issue in a more climate conscious way.
So let's bring it back to the pump, Ellen. What can we expect as far as prices are concerned in the weeks and months ahead?
After the summer driving season ends, as we shift into the autumn, we can definitely see demand go down. And chances are gasoline prices are also going to start to fall. Are they going to fall as much as back to where they were in years prior? Probably not, because oil prices are still pretty high. Now, if something were to happen that could cause oil prices to drop, like massive lockdowns all over the world, that would definitely cause a drop in gasoline prices.
Ellen Wald is a non-resident senior fellow with the Atlantic Council Global Energy Center. Ellen, thanks very much for your insights on the current oil situation. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. For centuries, a large number of Jews lived in Mosul, Iraq. In the 1950s, they fled, and their history was pretty much forgotten. Now, a Muslim man is working to make sure it doesn't totally disappear.
They are people who deserve to be recognized as equal citizens of Mosul as anyone else.
That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Throughout the pandemic, the U.S. has been closed to most foreign visitors. As it prepares for the eventual opening, the Biden administration is working on a policy that would require COVID vaccines for entry. Europe has already established a so-called green pass. Travelers within the EU show their vaccination status and pass on through. Here's the catch, though. Not all vaccines are accepted. And as the world's Elana Gordon reports, this has implications for vaccination programs across the globe.
After more than a year of mostly hunkering down in her apartment in Berlin, Dara Hassel finally ventured out this week to the black beaches of the Canary Islands, part of Spain.
I think I'm having like a pretty normal vacation considering
pandemic. On a bus tour Wednesday, ascending up the volcanic mountains, everyone wore masks. They had assigned seats. But getting above that cloud line beneath the sun was all worth it.
It was just really impressive and beautiful.
Traveling to the islands was pretty simple, too. Hassel is vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson shot, so she could register for a digital pass in Germany. All she had to do was present that on her phone at both airports.
So I just showed them. They didn't do anything with it. They didn't take a copy of it or anything like that.
This system is part of Europe's Digital Green Pass program. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen laid out the plan last spring.
With this digital certificate, we aim to help member states reinstate the freedom of movement in a safe, responsible, and trusted manner.
The idea is to have a centralized way for countries to recognize whether EU residents are vaccinated, COVID negative, or recovered from COVID, so they can easily travel between countries. But for people like Jihan, with family from outside the EU, it's been a mess. We're only using her first name out of concern for her mom's visa application. Jihan lives in Germany. Her mom's in Morocco. They've really wanted to see each other. They talk every day. Jihan didn't think it would be hard for her mom to enter because mom's fully vaccinated.
She got the Sinopharm, Chinese Sinopharm vaccine. She did both shots. And yeah, it's been 2 months.
But the EU pass in general only accepts vaccines that have been reviewed by the European Medicines Agency. So that's Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and the AstraZeneca vaccine made in Europe. Jihan says her mom hasn't been able to get a visa because Sinopharm is not on the list, even though the WHO has approved it.
Most of the countries in Africa, at least, these are the only vaccines they have access to. So then what? They just stay there? They cannot move freely anymore?
What is at stake is that it will bring now discrimination.
Dr. Sodi Munsaka is dean of the School of Health at the University of Zambia. He chairs the country's COVID Ethics Committee.
These green passes are unethical and problematic. They need to be revisited and changed.
Munsaka says this goes beyond the science, especially when vaccines that got greenlit by the WHO don't make the cut. That also includes the most widely used vaccine in low- and middle-income countries, the Indian-made AstraZeneca vaccine, also known as Covishield.
And for me, actually, as a scientist, it should not actually matter.
Now he's hearing stories of people not being allowed into Europe because they received Covishield. He says it's racist. Leaders in Africa and at the WHO have slammed the EU vaccine policy. Jeffrey Lazarus at the Barcelona Institute for Global Health says he understands the reasoning behind it.
I think right now, at this stage of the pandemic, where things are actually getting worse in the European Union, that it makes sense that they only accept the vaccines that their European Medicines Agency has approved.
Individual countries are still setting their own requirements, and some do allow vaccines like Covishield that are not on the EU list. Lazarus says either way, he hopes countries permit international travelers to present some alternatives.
Which could be other ways to prove that you don't have the virus, which would be getting tested.
Alternatives aside, this question of which vaccines count threatens vaccine uptake elsewhere. Catherine Chikchunji leads the African Population and Health Research Center in Nairobi, Kenya. She says policies like the EU's are setting up a hierarchy, a perception of first and second tier vaccines.
If it stays that way, I think it's going to be chaos.
Chikchunji says she worries about growing distrust in the vaccines that are available, even though, for the most part, all of them dramatically reduce serious illness, hospitalization, and death.
It's ridiculous because the message is whichever vaccine you get, take it. Now people have to make choices.
For Chikchunji, she was desperate to get whatever vaccine she could as her colleagues started falling ill with COVID. In May, she got her first dose of Covishield. A weight lifted. Then she decided to hold off on a second dose because she had the chance to get a different vaccine in Maryland.
So taking a risk to fly is a risk I was willing to take to get fully vaccinated.
Chukchunji came with her husband, who returned to his U.S.-based job this summer. There, she's getting both shots of the Moderna vaccine, which she knows will be accepted around the world. She's relieved for her family, yes. But she's outraged at what this entire situation means for so many in Africa and beyond. For the world, I'm Alana Gordon.
We've been following the wildfires in Algeria this week. Those flames remain largely out of control. At least 69 people have died in numerous blazes across Algeria that began on Monday. The fires are being driven by extreme temperatures and high winds. Reporter Meir Mizrahi spent time in the most impacted region yesterday. He joins us from Algiers. So I understand you went to a village in the region of Tizi Ouzou where the fires have been the worst. Tell us what the conditions were like. What did you see?
I think the best word to describe the conditions would be apocalyptic. There was a sort of amber smoke that filled the air. You could feel it in your nostrils, in your lungs. It was hard to breathe. I saw one farm that stood sort of, again, apocalyptically, sort of seen one farm that stood on its own and all the land surrounding it was burnt to a crisp.
Yeah, apocalyptic is a pretty good word. What did people tell you about what they've been experiencing?
We spoke to some families that had evacuated their lands. They were living on the exterior part of the village. They had feelings of desperation, helplessness. They were sad and a little bit angry as well. The villagers that I'd spoken to said that the state hadn't come to evacuate them, that they had been relying on volunteers from the surrounding villages or from the city of Tizi Ouzou to come and organize evacuations. I drove by a police station that was completely closed. This is one of the first times in Algeria that I drive from village to village without going through a checkpoint or seeing even one police officer.
What has been the government response to the anger of the people you spoke with?
The president addressed the nation yesterday. He did say that the state was putting as much means as it could into fighting these fires. These forest fires are really ravaging all of northeastern Algeria, so the state's resources are very limited. They do not have, for example, firefighting aircraft like a Canadair, which is this airplane built in Canada that has capacity of 6,000 to 7,000 liters. People online were very angry that a country like Algeria, which has one of the largest military budgets in Africa, couldn't buy these Canadairs, despite the fact that we've struggled with these forest fires for a very long time.
So President Abdelmadjid Tebboune has been pretty adamant that he believes the fires have been set by arsonists. 22 people have been arrested. What evidence is there of arson?
Absolutely none. That's what activists and journalists have sort of been speaking out about because we see it as a sort of way of deflecting because the government has been so unprepared in fighting these fires. It's a way of saying, well, there's nothing we could have done anyways. These were lit intentionally. For me, these are irresponsible claims from the head of the government unless they can present evidence.
Yeah, and if they can't present evidence, if it becomes incontrovertibly clear that arson was not the cause, could the president pay a political price for simply not being on top of the fires?
No, unfortunately not in Algeria. I mean, there's no real structured political opposition. The president is backed by very strong institutions in Algeria, so I honestly don't see that happening.
So Algeria is just one country along the Mediterranean that's experiencing devastating fires right now. Is there much discussion among Algerians about how these fires might be driven by climate change, especially with the report that we saw this week from the UN?
Yeah, there is frustration in the sense that climate change is not really part of our discourse here. I can just point to the 2019 presidential debates. Not one single candidate spoke about climate change, despite the fact that this is a region, the Mediterranean region, but especially North Africa. This is a region that's really been threatened by water scarcity and drought. And yesterday we had a heat wave throughout the week, really, of temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius, winds of 20 kilometers an hour. And that's really what's feeding these flames.
Meir Mizrahi is a journalist in Algeria speaking with us from the capital, Algiers. Thank you very much for the update.
Thanks for having me on.
Modern Iraq, as it's defined by its current borders, is not that old, only dating back to the early 20th century and the end of the Ottoman Empire. The cultural identities and religious beliefs there go back much further. Take the area of northern Iraq. It's been a religiously diverse region for centuries. Earlier this week, we heard about the tension between two minority communities living in a historically Christian town there. Today, Rebecca Collard has a story of the Jews that once lived in the Iraqi city of Mosul and a new effort to preserve their memory.
Look at this house. Wow. In the rubble of Mosul's old city, there are signs of a forgotten past. In the concrete doorways of the houses here, I notice the imprints of mezuzahs, the small parchment scrolls fixed to the entrances of Jewish homes around the world.
Like this. Look, yes.
This one.
Oh, yeah, there it's much more obvious.
This neighborhood used to be called Mahalat el-Yahud, the place of the Jews. Today, much of it is in ruins. ISIS controlled the city of Mosul for 3 years. The militants' goal was to replace multi-religious Iraq with a Sunni Muslim caliphate. But Mosul's Jews were gone long before that. Most left in the 1950s, ending millennia of Jewish presence here. Now, as Mosul rebuilds, Mohammed Omar is trying to preserve the city's Jewish heritage.
They are people who deserve to be recognized as equal citizens of Mosul as anyone else.
Mohammed may seem like an unlikely candidate to lead the effort. He's best known for creating Mosul Eye, where he secretly published news during ISIS's occupation. Before that, he was a history lecturer at Mosul University. After the city was liberated from ISIS, his colleagues found something surprising.
Some of the houses that were demolished, in the structure of the walls, we found stones with Hebrew inscriptions in the walls.
And that raised questions for Mohammed.
Why I don't know who are the Jews who lived in Mosul. I am aware that there is something called the Jewish neighborhood in Mosul. But where are they? What happened to them? Who are they? Who were they? What they were doing in the city?
Mohammed says the city's Jews have been virtually erased from the history books. So he set out to find them.
Thank you, everyone, and especially to Sally.
In October, Omar Mohammed organized a virtual meeting. It brought together Jews from Mosul living around the world and their descendants. They spoke Arabic, English, and Hebrew.
Ustaz Maurice, hello, Ustaz.
In the past, Jews in Iraq were government ministers, businessmen, and some of the country's most popular musicians. What pushed them to leave is debated, even among the Iraqi Jews on the call.
They left by choice.
If you make the atmosphere so oppressive that you have no chance to live there, you're forced to leave. That doesn't mean by choice.
That's correct.
As far as I'm concerned, the Jews were expelled.
With the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and the rise in anti-Jewish violence, most of Iraq's Jewish population fled the country. That meant leaving the land of their ancestors. Mohammed's plan is to create a virtual museum with interviews with those who fled and photos from the once vibrant Jewish community of Mosul. He says he hopes in the future he will be able to set up a physical museum in the city.
And then it will become a widely public space for the people to know that when you look at Mosul, you know that the Jewish history is an essential part of it.
There was never a perfect coexistence in Iraq, but Mohammed says the real problem started a century ago when the British carved out an Iraqi state with borders that were irrelevant to the people who lived there.
Religious diversity in Iraq was heavily damaged after the 1920s. It created the confusion. The people started forgetting about what their identity is.
Mohammed says the newly imagined Iraqi nationality didn't match the historical or cultural realities. And he says that's still causing problems today.
Until now, you don't understand what the national identity of Iraq is. And no government was able to clearly define what the national identity is.
Back in Mosul's old Jewish quarter, it's difficult to find residents old enough to remember living side by side with Jewish neighbors. But I meet Abdul Karim Salah, who's in his 60s.
My friend in the school, Joseph, was Jewish. He became Muslim.
Salah says some of the Jews here converted to Islam so they could stay. He blames the national Iraqi government for stoking tensions between religious communities here.
They made hate between Muslim and Jewish, and they succeed.
He leads me through winding narrow alleyways, pointing out homes that used to belong to Jewish families.
All this area, I told you, belonged to the Jews.
Eventually, we come to a dead end with a rusting metal door.
And this is their temple.
This is their temple?
Yeah. This is the door from here.
The door is barred shut, but the neighbors let us climb to their roof to look inside.
This way or up?
From here, we can see into an ornate synagogue with richly colored wall tiles, high arches, and thick columns. There isn't much left of the synagogue's roof, and it looks a bit like it's now being used as a garbage dump. The physical scale of the damage to Mosul's Jewish history feels impossible to repair, and there are still whole swaths of the city to restore for the communities that still live here. But Saleh says his Jewish neighbors would be welcome back.
This is their home. This is their temple. We have no right to prevent them.
There's a story about the late Salima Pasha, a famous Iraqi Jewish singer in the 1950s. It's difficult to confirm, but even the story's existence tells of a different time for Iraq's religious minorities. My Iraqi friend tells me that two other prominent Jewish Iraqi musicians were leaving for Israel, and they tried to convince her to join them.
So they went, they visited Salima Pasha, and they told her, hey, we're leaving, you should leave with us as well. And she literally, her reply was, this is my homeland. My people are over here.
Pasha converted to Islam and stayed. Amid the rubble of their neighborhood, I try to imagine Mosul's once vibrant Jewish community. How people would have sat here in their homes, listening to the songs of Pasha, with the feeling that this was their homeland. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard, Mosul.
Rebecca's report is part of our series Sacred Nation, stories about religion and nationalism around the globe. It's funded by the Henry Luce Foundation. Check out more of the series at theworld.org/sacrednation. Srebrenica, 1995, site of the worst mass killing on European soil since World War II. 8,000 Muslim men and boys were murdered by Bosnian Serb forces. International courts have ruled that what happened was genocide. But for decades, Serbian leaders in Bosnia-Herzegovina have denied that. Now, a new law banning genocide denial has come into force there. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Emir Suligic says his family fled to Srebrenica in 1992. The United Nations said the small mountain town was safe and under UN protection. Anyway, Suligic says he and his family, who are Muslim, had no option but to flee their home in eastern Bosnia.
We had to go because they would come to our village, round up everyone, separate women and children, deport them. Some were picked for rape. Men were taken to detention facilities. A number of them were shot. Most of my family members were actually killed in 1992. So, yeah, that's why we had to run.
Suligic was just 17 when he arrived in Srebrenica, and he says it felt anything but safe.
It felt like an open-air concentration camp. I lived in the conditions of an open-air concentration camp between May 1992 and July 1995.
That's when the worst atrocities of the Bosnian War were carried out. In Srebrenica, Bosnian Serb forces systematically rounded up and executed thousands of Bosnian Muslims. Today, Suligic is the director of the Srebrenica Genocide Memorial. But at the time, he worked as an interpreter for the UN. And he tells me he only survived because of two men.
There were two Americans, one former American lieutenant colonel and another young American lawyer. His name is Ed Joseph. The other guy's name was Kenneth Beiser. They essentially wrote a legal memo, sent it to the UN headquarters, and then they essentially got me and other interpreters out of Srebrenica.
Suligic went on to report on the International Criminal Tribunal in the former Yugoslavia. It helped document the full extent of what happened during the war. Serge Brammertz was the tribunal's chief prosecutor at the time.
You know, we had in court more than 5,000 witnesses testifying about the atrocities. We have videos of execution of prisoners, videos of bombardments of churches, mosques.
Brammert says the tribunal had no doubt that what happened at Srebrenica was an act of genocide. But to this day, Bosnian Serb leaders continue to deny it. When former Serb leader Radovan Karadzic was charged with genocide in 2012, he told the court he should be praised for his efforts to promote peace.
Zbog zbivanja u našem građanskom ratu,
I did everything possible to avoid war, Karadžić said, but he was eventually convicted of genocide. That's what prompted the top international official in Bosnia, Valentin Insko, to push for a new law banning genocide denial. Insko was the UN's high representative in Bosnia for 12 years. Political scientist Jasmin Mujanović is originally from Sarajevo. He says Insko worked for several years to put the law in place.
Ultimately, you know, it was really literally the waning hours of his mandate. And it was quite a big surprise, I think, both to informed observers and even political actors within Bosnia and within the international community that ultimately Mr. Insko decided to impose the law.
Today, anyone in Bosnia who denies that genocide happened or glorifies war criminals like Radovan Karadžić could face a prison term of up to 5 years. Mujanović says people like Karadžić and former Serb commander Ratko Mladic are still revered by some Serbs today.
So, for instance, we had a match in the southwest of Serbia, in a part of Serbia where there is actually a large Bosniak community. And one of the two main clubs out of Belgrade, Partizan, was visiting. And, you know, their fans in the stands were chanting the name of Ratko Mladic. They were holding up banners with his face. So this is what we sometimes call genocide triumphalism.
While Mujanović is among many Bosnians who welcomes the ban on genocide denial, some are already slamming it. Milorad Dodik, a top Bosnian Serb official, told reporters recently that the ban could threaten the country's future. This is a nail in the coffin of Bosnia-Herzegovina, Dodik said. A week after the ban was announced, the parliament of the Serb-dominated region of Bosnia, Republika Srpska, passed a law blocking it. And then it passed a second law, saying that anyone who accused the Serb-led entity of genocide could themselves face up to 15 years in jail. But this counter-ruling is unlikely to be made law nationwide. And UN Chief Prosecutor Serge Brammert says the ban on genocide denial is already having an effect.
Since the day this law came into force, well, there has been almost no public comment in relation to genocide denial. So we see somehow in the public domain that politicians are now becoming a little bit more careful about what they are saying and what they are doing.
It's not clear, though, if the ban will actually lead to any prosecutions. Corruption is a big problem within Bosnia's justice system. But Brammert says anything that curbs the denial of what happened in Srebrenica 26 years ago can only be a good thing. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
The past few days, we've been bringing you highlights from the all-important UN climate report published on Monday. As we close out the week, one more IPCC report takeaway for you from the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
Climate change is, of course, global. But really, we all want to know the same thing.
So what does this mean for me?
This is Co Barrett, one of the scientists who led the UN's climate assessment. She says they tried to answer that question by zeroing in for the first time on regional impacts.
And this improved regional focus is really very helpful in starting to bring the granular information that decision makers most need.
A couple of examples here. The eastern U.S. is expected to see more annual precipitation and the flooding that goes with it, but the central and western U.S. will have more drought. Northern Africa is going to get less windy, while the southern part of the continent will see more wind. Monsoon rains in Central and South America will decrease, but over the long term in Asia, they'll increase. No surprise that some scientists like to call this climate weirding. Paula Andrea Arias Gomez is another author of the report. She says it's written specifically so policymakers can figure out how to respond to climate change with concrete action.
I am particularly from Colombia, northwestern South America. And for me, it's very important that this report is giving regional information that is going to help us to make decisions.
The report even has an interactive map where you can see just how much hotter things are likely to get in your backyard. Good timing in a summer filled with record-breaking heat waves. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
On our Twitter feed, we just posted the link to that interactive climate map. We are at The World. Our show comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. As you know, you can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong and cool this weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
From PRX.